Ette Davies, sure. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm not even going to let you say thank you for having me because I always.
I was about to say
no,
that.
No, you're not allowed to today. Right. So look, you. If I looked at you as a profile, okay, you're this global CEO, ex CEO of Engine. Yeah. Before then, you were managing director at Analog Folk, and then before then had this amazing career at AKQA. Right, there's a whole profile that I see when I look at you. But every time you and I meet, I see a human being. Thanks. A very relatable, kind, thoughtful human being. And so I always like to start this podcast by asking, who was the first person that made you feel talented?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've just said enough to make me feel
was that, was that the first person?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I'll take that. But like, seriously, I should get you to write my my bios, because it's much better than sort of the professional stuff that you have to write normally. First person that would make me feel talented, you know, there's a part of me that like would be really remiss if I didn't say my mum. Do you know what I mean? And so goes without saying that, you know, your parents make you feel special or talented, but if I was to sort of point to one person sort of outside of my parents, it would be my English teacher, Mr. Mannion, in secondary school. And the main reason for that was like I was not like an unacademic child, but I just didn't really apply myself and got into all kinds of trouble, just not really like behaving or sort of paying any kind of attention in school the whole way through. I mean, maybe typical sort of teenage boy behaviors or, you know, whatever else. At the time, we'd moved from Lewisham in London to Kent. And I just started this school in Canterbury. And the time that we'd moved to sort of Folkestone and this school in Canterbury, I was like the only black kid, I think, in the year. And then also, I think, one of maybe two or three in the whole school, you know. So it was, I mean, it's very different now, the sort of environment there. But there was kind of that pressure. They were sort of coming to this new school with, like, this school report from my previous school, which was not flattering or favourable. And I was, like, I think 13 or so. I, like, distinctly remember, you know, the first day that I was there and going to classes. And you'd get that moment where the teacher would go, okay, here's a new kid. And it was quite clearly sort of debriefed on you. And yeah, I remember one class, the teacher was even like, oh, I don't think you're supposed to be in this class. I was supposed to be in it because, you know, I'd done the grade, but they just didn't want a problem child. Yeah. And I had this English teacher and he was like your sort of typical kind of cool teacher. You know, he had like movie posters on the wall. Yeah. He taught film. Do you know
sat
what I mean?
On
like,
the chair the wrong
yeah,
way around.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah, he was that sort of vibe. So, you know, instantly we all thought he was the best thing on earth. But what he did, because I've never really been tested, sort of being dyslexic, but I always struggled with syntax, particularly in school and, you know, grammar and stuff, which I think didn't help my general application. But I remember in his reports, he would essentially say the content of what you write far exceeds anything that anyone's sort of putting together in terms of what you're saying. Like the syntax is an issue, but we can work on it. But it's sort of that kind of point where someone actually saw beyond the, you know, the point you said before, the reputation of a problem, and actually saw that there was something else within there that was, you know, above kind of average or something sort of special, and then actually to tell the person that. Yeah. I think that was probably the first sort of articulated moment that I could think of. Wow. Someone said it to me sort of outside of Mum saying, oh, you know, you're all special.
kind of thing. Which we're all special. Yeah. I mean, come on, there's only one of me.
Because she has to. Well, actually, if you ask my brother and sister, she has favourites.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. She's got favourites.
Where are you, like?
I'm the favourite child.
No, of course. Yeah.
Well, that's what they say. I have a different opinion. But, you know.
It was how you feel, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, right. I mean, thank you for that. That's helpful to know. Yeah. Like, well, I think I had a similar situation. Weird, I think, with my English teacher as well. So then, I want to skip from then to CEO because I think that the bit that obviously you do so much around inclusivity and getting people to come from different backgrounds into this industry. But what were your core set of skills? So like, and how did you discover and access the industry now?
Yeah, it's a really good question. In truth, I think I'm actually always learning my sort of core set and skills. Like it's I assume you do as well, sort of quite self-aware, so spend quite a lot of time sort of evaluating where you are and where you're going, and you know what you're learning as well, which is a sort of big part of it. And I think that in itself has been one of the, I guess, sort of fundamental skills or characteristics that I have, which is that flexibility and that ability to sort of learn and adapt. And you know, I've changed so many roles across my sort of career journey, worked in lots of different environments. A lot of the time, it would be the first time I'd sort of worked in that kind of setup, and you know, the learning curve has always been like that. And I quite enjoy it, but I know that like when I'm learning and sort of like, you know, sort of building skills or experience or pushing myself out of my comfort zone is what I enjoy the most. So I think that sort of, that kind of core skill around that adaptability and that ability to learn is there. The other thing that I think I've developed a knack for is being able to get groups of people who may not necessarily have had similar opinions, or you know, might not have the same sort of objective or like different skill sets or point of views, to come together around like a shared objective. And it's probably why I ended up in project management initially, because that's when you just got to pull all these different skills across the business, work against like a ridiculous deadline, sort of budget challenges and, you know, client pressures to get to something great or sort of special at the end. And then, you know, as you sort of build your career, you go from doing that like on a team and a client level to going, how do you create the right environment to do that? So I'd say, yeah, that sort of adaptability and sort of learning, and then also being able to bring teams and lead them towards something.
But as like a 18-year-old or whenever you entered, I don't know if you went to university, like were you organized? Because if you started in project management, like what was your core skill? Like for me, it was people like my family or like my English teacher would say, you can talk a lot, right? So I looked at jobs that I was going to be an estate agent. What was, imagine there's an 18-year-old person now being like, oh, he's good at X, I should probably try doing
this. Do you know, sort of going back actually to the bit about the English teacher, it was in his report, he said that I had like an analytical mind. And at the time, you know, I was like 13, 14, I knew what the word meant, but I thought it was an insult in terms of what he was saying. It's like, what does he mean? So there's some,
I would have heard that like manipulative.
Problem
like.
With me. Yeah, it's like, but I think it was because, it probably goes back to that thing of like learning and being able to sort of like wanting to sort of pick things apart and study them and then break them down. And then figure out either why things work the way they do and how they can be changed. And so I actually followed a study and sort of academia path, going to uni and so on, that was like science based. Partly because, you know, like if you're like West African immigrant families, there's only, well, at the time I was like going to uni, there's only like so many career choices you can take. Everyone's pushing you to be like a doctor or a lawyer or engineer or a pharmacist. Like any other career just doesn't exist. Do you know what I mean?
After what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, you know, even I think it wasn't until I was the MD of Analog Folk that my parents, well, my dad in particular, actually realized that my job wasn't sales, and they were sort of telling other people, this is what he does, you know, we're really proud of him, look, he's in the newspaper, this industry magazine. And then suddenly you're like wheeled out at family events to talk to the younger ones who are not quite sure where their future are going, because it's a career now. So I was
like, 15 years
exactly that, 50 years for family recognition, you know, never mind what was going on outside. So I was sort of headed down a path, I think, that would have ended up going down something which was a bit more, maybe science-based, you know, a bit more potentially like teaching or so on. Although I never really had a motivation to teach, but it was kind of, I guess, the career that you would choose unless you wanted to work in a lab. I really didn't want to do any of those things and kind of fell into this, really.
So I'm hearing analytical mind. What makes you unique? Just from hearing you speak for like 5 minutes now. Analytical mind times storytelling human being that can pull together a team of people around an objective.
Yeah.
Because my next question was going to be around, okay, project manager, but I don't know how many, I don't even know if I know any other project managers that have made it to a CEO role.
Yeah.
So project manager at AKQA, and what was the moment where you went, oh, I'm a little bit different?
Yeah, I am, it's a good question. Maybe I've always been a little bit different. I think, because I think I've always been someone who understands processes and systems and structures and, you know, how to design systems, you know, which is core to every sort of PM, and how to put that operating structure into things. But there's always been a part of me that sees wider than that. You know, there are some, you know, I understand why you might have a methodology, but I'm not the sort of person who will be purist enough for it to get in the way of delivering to an objective. And as I've always been quite an entrepreneurial person. Do you know what I mean? Always trying to find some way to sort of hustle to put things together, you know, whether that is side gigs or, you know, getting myself into various bits of trouble at school, trying to, you know, sell trainers or whatever it is, right? So there's always been a part of me that, in a weird sort of way, has been in, you know, you asked the question before about being the organized. There's always been a part of tension, I think, between like one half, which is exactly what, you know, you'd expect an ops program project manager to be in terms of how they think and how they're structured. And then an inherent characteristic to want to have that sort of disruptive side and the sort of what if kind of questions to things, rather than going, well, here's a set of rules, we're just going to follow these rules. There's another part that goes, well, actually, you know, F the rules. So to speak. You know, there's a path, the path of least resistance there. So that's always been like a characteristic. And when I, you know, when I started at agency world, I was always quite client facing and always was more interested, or equally as interested, in what we were making and how it would benefit the client ultimately in terms of their wider challenge, as much as the process of getting to the making it, you know, which a lot of, you know, producers, rightly so, are sort of obsessed on that part of the craft. So I found myself in, I guess as a consequence, like a lot of teams and clients where I was able to sort of flex on both sides, and so be more than a project manager or more than a program manager. And then, you know, AKQA was probably the really pivotal moment of breaking out of practice into sort of other leadership roles, because it, you know, everyone in AKQA was expected to be multifaceted and, you know, to be A, very much entrepreneurial, but, you know, B, strategic and B, creative, and as well as an expert in their core discipline and practice. And it was sort of baked into the culture and in the talent that was sort of hired, which is, you know, why the agency was and does such great things. And so I was, you know, on the Nike account, part of a team where we were all quite fluid in terms of what we did. Yes, you had your core area of practice, but, you know, you're expected to be able to manage a client relationship, to, you know, grow, grow a client business, be able to think beyond just the client as well as to what it means in terms of how we were building the account more broadly. And, you know, as part of that leadership team, and I was really fortunate we started to work internationally and set up offices in the US and in Asia, and in you know, all over Europe. And the real career switching point was towards the end of my time, I think the last year and a half at AKQA, we were switching out, we were sort of transforming the Shanghai office, which had a bulk of work that we did with Nike, but then also some other clients. And there was, you know, we were making some changes in the leadership team, as well as trying to sort of re-energize and revive that office and bring it back up to the expected reputation that an AKQA entity has to deliver on, you know, in terms of its work, its, you know, its team, its culture, its sort of clients in that market. I'd been out to Shanghai a few times with the Nike account, with Nike work, but then because we were changing the leadership team out, myself and a few of the others who were across that international leader team were taking in turns to be the acting MD in the Shanghai office. And I love that experience for like a lot of reasons. One was going in and, you know, being turning around. Yeah, being an MD, turning it around, working with the leadership team that were there to think about strategically, where is this, you know, business going? What's the plan? What's our proposition? What's the sort of culture we want to build? You know, supporting the hiring process of bringing the new leaders in, working with the clients in the market to refine the AKQA product. So it was, you know, the brand experience was consistent, but, you know, sort of how we delivered and, you know, what we created was relevant to what clients needed in the region in China, which, you know, itself was also a massive learning experience because I'd never experienced anything like that sort of culturally. The time I was in China and both in Japan as well. So there was a lot of personal growth that was going on as well as career growth.
Wow. Got to the end of that. There's like growth squared there.
Yeah,
it's like
totally I'm doing that. Client totally
stuff,
that.
Project management stuff, yeah, yeah. Cultural stuff.
Yeah, completely. It was, I mean, it was, I would say that was a transformative point in both my personal and professional kind of career, just because of all that stuff that was going on and sort of taking that opportunity. And it was at the end of that sort of period of time, you know, that when I sort of came back and just thought, actually, I've gone pretty much as far as I could go in terms of the expertise of practice in program management and delivery and operations, because I was, you know, international head of delivery, but I'd really enjoyed leaning more into business leadership and, you know, being the MD. And that's when the, you know, just serendipity that the AF conversation just seemed to be happening at around almost the exact same time that I'd gone through that experience.
So it's right at the end of, I always say like move at the end of the season, right? Mm. Every role has a season.
Yeah.
And it's really tempting to stay on because you're the guy. You know, I've been in this role, I've made all this change, I can collect all my spoils here, I've got this respect.
Yeah.
But the season's finished.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you see life as estate agencies and they go, why didn't I change or get paid more? And you didn't move at the end of the season.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a really accidental, maybe not, who knows, end of season moment where analog folk go, cool, we see that you've done that.
Yeah.
Come join our thing.
Yeah.
What, how was that sold to you? How was that that situation there?
So I am, there was a recruiter that had worked at AKQA and he'd gone over to AF, and they had an MD in the London office, a guy called Matt Law, and he was moving into another role, but they hadn't told me about it. He was moving to like one of the global roles, and the founders of Analog Folk, like Matt, Dyke and Bill, they had been at Tribal where I'd worked at before. We never crossed over, but like we sort of had circles and we knew each other, and you know, they had clearly have heard of me from other people. And initially, my recruiter friend, like Ravi, said, look, they're looking for like a head of delivery role. Do you want to come over and sort of do that, do the role there? And I said, no, I'm really looking for like an MD role. And I can't remember how that got back to Bill or to Matt. But I ended up going in, and I went in under the premise that I was having a conversation about a potential future MD role. Yeah. Bill was also scouting for his MD role at the time. The recruiter thought I was there to talk about the sort of head of delivery role, because they just, the head of delivery role I just left as well. You know, almost instantly from sort of that conversation with Bill and just, you know, seeing the clarity of purpose that they had in the business, the sort of the independent spirit, the sort of like, you know, the rapport that you build with somebody instantly, I was like, okay, I can feel like I could really work here. And, you know, and with Bill and Matt and sort of everybody else. But then the opportunity and the need that they had was, you know, they'd been growing and being quite successful, but they were still, I guess, in that kind of startup phase, and they, you know, they were about to go on that trajectory to be a scale up. But in order to get there, there were things that they needed to put in, going back to the point around operations and structure and rigor around, you know, the operating model, how the proposition gets, you know, evolved, how they set themselves up for success to scale and, you know, deliver bigger clients, what that means in terms of like culture and structure, for them to move into the next league, you know, as you know, they would sort of kind of position it. And so much of what I've been doing to date on that sort of operational structural delivery side was so foundationally important to allow them to get to that higher ambition.
Yeah.
But what they needed was somebody who could put that stuff in, but then also think about the higher ambition and lead there. And they were very much, it is a very culture and people driven business, what it was at the time. So they needed somebody who wouldn't just come in and mechanically look at revenue and costs and kind of, you know, sort of products and services, but not actually realize that all of that is a product of talent and culture, you know, which is sort of always been a driving thing for me. So they, so that it was kind of like, it was just, as you say, the end of season, maybe a bit of fortune, like kind of right place, right time. So I left that conversation and, you know, Bill said, well, we need someone immediately to come in and sort the delivery stuff because we've just lost our delivery guy. But then there is this MD role and, you know, I want you to sort of take it, and we'd move to it quite quickly. I didn't realize he meant 3 months after joining, you know, which was actually, you know, quickly and in sort of a good way as well, you know, rather than being stuck in the delivery role for too long. But part of it was to get an understudy ready to sort of take over. Yeah, and that was it. Yeah,
I get the sense when I chat to you, I always, you know, we speak about like happy times and that kind of stuff. I kind of got two questions really. One is, how did you know if your appointment had been successful? Was there like a dashboard that you were measuring that with? Was it a feeling? Was it an achievement? Like,
yeah,
a year in, how do you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, It's a bit of both, to be honest with you. I am, you know, the AF role in particular, I always felt very supported by the founders, because they knew that they were taking a bit of a punt on someone who hadn't been, you know, sort of an MD before, to run what was the biggest office that they had in the network. And they consciously did that, and they were clear with me as well, is that, you know, we want to create an opportunity for you, and, you know, we've got confidence, we know there are gaps there, but, you know, you can learn from both of us, you know, Bill and Matt, in terms of different, you know, kind of areas. And Bill was, you know, the thing that I'd sort of learned from Bill, which I still, you know, have to this day, I think, and kind of my tenet of skills, is he was very good, well, both him and Matt were very good at, like, okay, here is our plan on a page, our strategy for the year, really simply articulated, that sort of ties back to overall business proposition and like the sort of key, you know, sort of core initiatives, like two or three things you'll do in sort of like people, product, you know, profit or whatever, that will help you deliver on that and how you'll measure it. So there was that kind of structural framework, which, you know, I guess, you know, obviously everybody has, but, you know, you sort of use that to plan and check the sort of commercial, operational, you know, sort of the sort of tangible performance of the business throughout the year, or, you know, what you're delivering in terms of mission. But then the other part, you know, you said feeling, and I think that was a really key part, is do I feel like I am, you know, making a difference to the company in my contribution, my leadership, either in the environment that, you know, people are working in, where they feel like it's a place that they, you know, people talk about safe spaces, places people have the opportunity to think, you know, sort of freely and collaborate well, and feel like there is something that they can contribute, you know, and it's sort of like a mutually beneficial, and that's intangible. I mean, you only really get that from being in the business, so to speak, like talking to people, spending time, and observing what's going on, and doing that without ego, you know, because it's very easy if people are saying things that aren't great and they're having a negative experience, you know, because you're in charge, you sort of take it personally and you go, well, actually, I think it's all fine. Why can't you see what I'm trying to do? Actually, you have to separate your ego from that and look at it from their perspective. So it was a bit of a balance of both of those things. And if anything, I think probably indexed a bit more into the feeling side of things in the first year. And part of that was, as I said, that I think the freedom that I was given by the founders, really, because, you know, I was building on the path of success that they had and sort of helping them sort of evolve. So it allowed me to focus a bit more on making sure we created the right environment for the talent to sort of thrive. And it sort of led to success. I mean, we won tons of awards, you know, acquired a ton of global clients, the network was expanding globally, but we also started to expand into Amsterdam. So yeah, it was a bit of that. I mean, now what I do is I have a lot more personal structure where I'll write down some, there'll be the sort of business facing,
yeah,
you know, sort of objectives, similar to the framework that I mentioned before that I'm sure everybody sort of uses when they plan their year out. But then I'll do something similar. I know we've talked about this before, where you kind of write down, okay, your own personal strategy, both related to the business, but yourself and what you want to kind of achieve. And I am a lot more conscious now of checking in on that more regularly, yeah, and going, actually, if I'm not devoting enough energy to getting to these things, are they the right things?
Yeah.
You know, or do I need to sort of be applying myself differently?
Do you know what's mad? Mm. When you were speaking about that analog folk role, that was a really good role. Like, and I don't mean that like flippantly, like, oh, weren't you so lucky to have it? Yeah. I mean how it was set up, right? Yeah. So I speak about these five elements.
Yeah.
And I actually recommend anybody using these five elements when they're thinking about leaving their job or thinking about joining a new place, right? Yeah. And look, that's what I was listening for when you were speaking about analog folk, right? Scarf.
Yeah.
I speak about scarf quite a lot, right?
Yeah.
So S is for status.
Yeah.
Have I been given the right status to do my role?
Yeah.
Managing director? Yeah. Yes, very clear.
Yeah.
Clarity, you were so clear. You had the object, like the three elements that role was broken down by.
Yeah, yeah.
Super clear what they expected from you, brilliant. A is autonomy. Most CEOs and managing directors that I speak to are leaving their job because they've got a fake CEO's role.
Yeah,
they've got the title, they've got the status, right? Yeah, and they've got the clarity with no fucking autonomy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's ripped away from them. It's like, go make all the change, but don't do it.
Yeah.
Right? The other one is relatedness. Like, do I feel like I'm in a group of people who want to achieve this thing?
Yeah.
And then the last one is fairness. Am I being paid and treated fairly?
Yeah.
Those five, it sounds like that was all five.
Yeah, yeah. I might steal that, actually.
Mate, that's quite scarf, good brother.
To sort of evaluate my stuff going forward.
Yeah, but always do it.
I like that, yeah.
And it comes up when you're having a conversation with like your boss or your peers or someone speaking to you.
Mm.
Every single time when someone says, I'm feeling not right, I guarantee one of those things will be there.
Yeah.
I stole it from a lady called Kate Sotheby, who's a neuroscientist.
Mm. Yep.
She uses that when anyone, not just employees, but when any human in a relationship is feeling disgruntled, generally it'll be one of those five things.
Yeah, yeah.
It's mad.
Yeah, I mean, it's brilliant. It's brilliant sort of articulation because it's all of those things were ticked, I think, in that experience. And you know, people say that thing of, you know, if you're in the right place, then work doesn't feel like work. It feels like, you know, you're enjoying it. And for actually a long period, not because, you know, there were obviously some challenging times, but for the bulk of my time in AF, I don't think there was a single day I was apprehensive about going into the office. Do you know what I mean? Or apprehensive about doing the job role. In fact, it was the, you know, the opposite. I loved the job, like every single day of doing it. Do you know what I mean? I loved the team, loved the, you know, the work that we were doing, the clients we were working with. It didn't feel like work. It didn't feel taxing at all. And actually then started to feel quite natural, as you're saying, because all the pieces were sort of in place.
Then the big I'm going through your career. We can skip past the bits if you don't want to be in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I guess there's the status looming, the, oh my God, engineer knocking.
Yeah.
They want to call me a CEO. Mm. It's a bigger toy box, right? I've got, what was WCRS, Partners Angela Aldridge, Caravan, Trailer Park.
Trailer Park.
This soap bar of fucking businesses crammed together and they go, you're the man that's going to glue it all together.
Yeah.
I can imagine there's some ego in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there some... Let's go through the scarf. Mm. Okay, so status, we got a big tick. Mm-hmm. We got the CEO.
Yeah.
Clarity?
No. There was
right.
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, I didn't ask enough questions, you know? And I don't know if it would have made me change taking the engine role, but I was naive in truth, do you know what I mean? And so I didn't really ask the clarity going in. I there was almost this sort of explanation that everything's a bit of a mess, but there's an opportunity there, and you'll never be able to don't worry about the mess it is now and think of what it could become, which is kind of clarity, I guess, but it's also not.
It's a bit like going on a date with a guy and like, I've cheated on all my ex-girlfriends, this time
totally. So that was as you say, the status sort of overweighing the clarity point in it. And actually, the clarity was a challenge in that role throughout, I think. But
so that was the hard thing. I looked at that. I think we had a chat afterwards, and you know, That's a really hard brief. And one of my questions I want to ask you is consolidation, right?
Mm.
We're in a time in Adland where Accenture buys Calm Rama, buys Droga5, and then becomes Accenture Song.
Mm.
You've taken like 12 different specialist agencies and glued them into one.
Yeah.
We spoke outside about Wunderman Thompson.
Yeah.
Fucking, actually, Wunderman, JWT, VML, Rainey Kelly, and all of them glowing into one thing, right?
Yeah,
and at one point that was brand,
you
know, direct mail, CRM, production, data, fucking everything, right?
Yeah.
And they've just gone zoom.
Yeah.
This is a big question to answer, but how the fuck does an agency, well, firstly, why are they doing it? I'd love to know from a client perspective.
Yeah.
Why is this a good move?
Yeah, I mean, so the answer to that, I think, is one of those that every agency will post-rationalize, do you know what I mean? To sort of, whether the true reason that they may be doing it is, you know, sort of cost efficiencies and, you know, sort of margin optimization. And in fact, maybe some of the businesses, there is that kind of bloat there. So operationally, it's the right thing to do. Which is a big reason, I think, you know, or one of the key reasons a lot of businesses do it. It might not be the hero one, but it definitely is one of the top reasons. The other strategic reasons, I feel like there's a lot of rationalization. Some of it might be based on elements of truth and kind of data around what the business perceives the opportunity in the market is and the general direction in terms of client needs and client services. I mean, the point around sort of integration and consolidation, you know, in itself is not, it's not a new concept. Mm. It's sort of like being touted a lot as here's this revolutionary thing that clients have been asking for. They want that, you know, kind of consolidation, integration, simplification and so on. It's like, I mean, yeah, like they've been saying that from the very beginning, even when things were separate. You know, I remember being in digital agencies, working with media agencies. They don't really, yes, they have the different agencies, but ultimately they want people to work together, you know, collaboratively to come up with their solutions. And if that means it all has to happen in one business and they can get that, then great. If you can get that, and we had it with AF, you know, where you have other partners, like independent media partners, but you work as one team and people aren't squabbling, you know, over like revenue scraps with each other as, you know, agency partners, and more sort of focus on what they're trying to help the client with.
Is that the problem then? So like, let's say I'm the CMO of, I don't want to use a current client of yours, Warburton's, right? Ex-client of yours.
Yeah.
I'm the CMO of Warburton's. I'm currently working with WCRS to do my brand, I guess a client would call it brand marketing.
Yeah.
What's happened in my day where I've gone, oh, can't you just all fucking work together? Like what's happened to for me to then signal to WCRS that I want them to all blend?
Yeah, so I mean, I think taking Warburton's out of it, because I think they were quite a good example of like how they worked well across the group. But to your point, in terms of what happens in the day, I think, obviously, I mean, we all know our clients have a ton of challenges over and above just the marketing and brand activity that we get, you know, briefed on. It's like a slither compared to the entire ecosystem of things that they are looking at within their business, but also within their sort of tasks. And so what they want from the genuine partners is somebody who can provide, like, can understand the challenges that they are facing, you know, across not just the bit that we engage in, but sort of the wider ecosystem, and think about how do you put together a solution, whether it's a campaign or whatever else, that solves the problem that you've been briefed on, but actually, you know, creates additional value sort of elsewhere. I think the challenge that sort of happens in the client's day is when, and you know, this can happen in the same holding company, right, where you have different agency and different talent partners that have a different perspective that's not aligned around the wider ecosystem challenges and the immediate one, that the inherent motivation for whatever solution or idea that they're providing is ultimately around how they maximize their growth and their opportunity rather than how they actually service
the client,
you, and service the client. And so that, you know, they're sort of sitting there and seeing, yeah, agencies squabble with each other, agencies not really understanding their need and trying to find ways to come up with, you know, solutions, ideas, things that help solve their challenges or their need, or working in partnership with them. And as I said, it's a fraction of what they do. It's obviously important, but it then just becomes problems where they're sort of arbitrating between, yeah, you know, different people. And actually, we should be working together to relieve some of the burden,
yeah,
on them, and helping, you know, helping them deliver on their sort of objectives. And so I think when there's that misalignment between the agencies, and even more than a misalignment either collectively or individually with what, you know, the client needs are, what they're trying to achieve, I think that's when you see the challenges start to sort of arise. I mean, without sort of naming any names, I've been in an agency environment where we were on a pitch, same client, and, you know, we got on the agency call, the pitch call, and everyone does the rounds of like, who are all the agencies there? And you have one agency that's in another geography, one same agency that we're in, one office in another geography. You know, we were in sort of one geography, like, you know, London, and there's like a pause, and the client goes, wait, you know, we actually only asked for one team from each agency. And the other office said, yeah, that's right, but we're pitching separately. And I think we got disinvited from the pitch as a result, because there's enough dysfunction happening in the world, and there's enough that particularly now clients have to deal with you know, sort of fragmented media, and even more complication with customers, let alone the people that are supposed to help you solve that are dysfunctional in themselves. Just like, I don't need that problem. Do you know what I mean? I just don't need that problem.
This is a mess. Yeah, I don't want to be involved in
that. Go and sort yourselves out, yeah, because whilst that's all happening, you're not doing anything that's of benefit to me or to my customers, you know?
So I get it from a client's, that's really helpful, by the way. Yeah. I've never thought about agencies being wrongly incentivized in a way. Yeah. Well, for them, for their survival, of course, their solution is going to be much more important than the other agency's solution. Yeah. I get it from the client side. Flip it. So agencies now that are going, okay, client wants us to consolidate.
Yeah.
What happens now? Let's say you've got I'm going to use an example that's not an agency that you've worked at. Let's say we're Wunderman Thompson right now.
Yeah.
Wunderman, digital marketing business, Thompson, brand above the line business, merging with VML, digital marketing business, and RKCR, YNR.
Yeah.
There is going to be so many like duplicates.
Yeah.
And in each of those businesses, right? You're going to have a project manager.
Yeah.
You know, I can't even say that there's a specialist project manager at Wunderman Thompson where there won't be a very similar version of that at VML, YNR.
Mm.
So when they come together, what is the reality of that? What happens?
I mean, it's messy. Having been on the inside of it, as an employee that's going through that merger, and then also as somebody who, you know, has the task of being part of an architect of, you know, that, it's not clean. I don't think what anyone ever says to you, because you are looking at, there is duplication, but even more challenging, you've got people that you're trying to, in some cases, consolidate into single teams or practices that are so different in skills. And, you know, as I mentioned before, there'll be a challenge to go, okay, how do we become more efficient? How do we actually become more connected? And then you suddenly realize, you know, the engine is a really good example, right? We had a sports marketing business and an events business, and then you have WCRS, and you're like, there is no similarity between these businesses other than they all work into the CMO. Like, rate cards are different, titles are different, like where they look for talent is different, the type of skills and experience the talent have is different, who they compete with in the market is just, it's miles apart. And so how do you bring all these things together without losing something? And, you know, there is always a risk, I think, that you lose something either in potential of where the business goes, or in terms of talent, or, you know, but as leaders, you have to resolve that. The only thing that you can have is a real clarity of intent around the new thing that you are building. What is the proposition of that, and why that has the sort of, ascending opportunity that you think is the right direction to follow. And then in order to build that thing, what are the component parts that, you know, you need to sort of put together?
Yeah.
And I know that sounds quite sort of, what's the word? Like
top level?
Disconnected from human, but it's the starting point that you need to kind of get to. And then you sort of look at, okay, what do we have? Do you know what I mean? In terms of people and talent, and, you know, also sort of clients in the mix. You know, what do we need to build in, you know, sort of buy in, what do we need to adapt, evolve, and also what do we then need to look at and go, that unfortunately doesn't fit.
Yeah.
You know?
What happened to, one of the things like I got from the Analog Folk story is that like brand of an agency, you know, remember the like Black Sheep of BBH or, you know, you had people that nothing is impossible, impossible is nothing, such and such. Yeah. There were these things that, okay, there were lines, but they were artifacts of businesses to be like, that's what we stand for.
Yeah.
What happened to that? Does that still exist?
Digital to make the analog world better. I think it does. You know, it's been a few years since I've been there, so I think it does.
The question is it dying with these consolidations?
Yeah.
How do you then get humans to then go, all right, the king is dead, long live the king. What is it now?
Yeah, like, I mean, that's the million-dollar question. And I think that is, you know, in truth, with a lot of these consolidations, there's a lot of narrative in some parts of, like, mission accomplished, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where people go, oh, yeah, we've consolidated, we've done. The only thing that they've actually done in reality is potentially change the logo on the door, you know, restructured some of the senior leadership and, you know, some of the kind of employees and, you know, obviously done some work around optimizing their costs. The point that you're saying in terms of getting clients and people on board with the new mission, the new mantra, the new purpose, even building that new brand, you know, out into the world, that is so far from, I think, genuinely complete, even started in many cases. And the truth of a lot of that is that that's the long game. Do you know what I mean? And it is part of the challenge with this sort of the narrative that gets communicated now around sort of integration and consolidations is because it's very focused on the commercial and the operational in the discussions. And there is some talk around, okay, we're bringing these brands together and here's a new brand. But brands are built over time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And cultures are built over time. And quality of like product and execution and creativity that refines, you know, kind of over time, especially if you want it to be repeatable. So my thing would be, let's see where a lot of this is in 5-6 years time to see what has really been the phoenixes that have been built out of sort of the ashes, so to speak, of all these bits and pieces. But you still have to have, you know, to your point, you still have to have the clarity of what the intent is. And I sometimes struggle with whether it's the word, you know, whether it's the purpose or proposition or whatever else, and kind of settle on the intent in terms of what is this group of people that ultimately form this business going to make, you know, sort of create, put into the world, you know, and work with clients that will set it apart from its competition.
Yeah.
And as a result of which, generate its success. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't know how many of the restructures that intent is clear. Do you know what I mean? I think there's lots of interesting words around brands and propositions and a lot of it's evolutions rather than, okay, what new is being created in the consolidations.
It's a fucking good answer.
Yeah.
I want to just, it would be criminal not to speak to you about inclusivity because you've, I mean, when you started We Are Stripes with your brother,
that's right. Yeah.
That was a new and scary thing to talk about. Mm. Like 8 years ago, you were speaking about how there wasn't enough access and opportunity to underrepresented talent coming into the industry.
Yeah.
I think you even said at the time that you were scared that that was going to damage your career.
Yeah, target on you your know. Back. Yeah.
Now, it, yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's, you can't look at an agency website or hiring policies without seeing that. Yeah. So you had to almost say like, the work that you did then has led on, you know, with the help and the aid of things like Black Lives Matter and George Floyd. That was genuinely punky and revolutionary like for then.
Yeah.
I want to, like, we're not, like you're saying about being in motion, we have not solved the diversity and inclusion problem within the industry. I want to ask honestly, what works?
Because
you've been involved in a few things, Culture Heroes, bunch of different things. I can imagine you're a very popular person. They're like, imagine someone go, we're doing a D&I thing. Can we bring you in and like solve our thing, right?
Yeah,
I bet you're very popular to bring. Yeah. So what, how do you quickly go, that's not going to work?
Yeah.
And how do you go, that's different, I like that?
Mm. Yeah, so it's a good question. Within within the agency sort of space, for me, there's like a couple of levers that let you know whatever activity is happening, you know, that something is likely to work. And one of them, which is rare, but like if there is direct pressure from clients on the business to have more representative, not just the work it creates, but employees, like nothing changes an agency more than what its clients do. I mean, we are what we eat, do you know what I mean, so to speak? So the minute that, you know, pitch decks, RFPs, or, you know, there is some sort of supplier agreement, which, and that's everything from inclusivity to sort of like ESG and sustainability. The minute that starts getting into either relationship conversations or contractual things, or even the shape of the clients start to change, that actually drives quite a lot of change within the agencies.
Okay.
But within the agency internally itself, a big part is it's really leadership buy-in. You know, like leadership have to believe that diversity and inclusivity will ultimately lead to better, like, creative product, as well as from a sort of imperative, like, commercial case. But then as individuals and people themselves are leaders, they also need to intuitively believe they want to create a company that's more reflective of the modern society. Do you know what I mean? And and want to create a company where people genuinely enjoy being in and sort of learn from each other, and there's a richness there. And you know, AF was a place where that was so front and center for Bill and Matt that, you know, they would pursue that even at the risk of
commerciality.
Do you know what I mean? And it paid off for them in a lot of ways. So I think once you get that leadership alignment, like intuitively and strategically, then you start to get the things around real investment in, like, you know, resources and finances towards change programs, towards looking at, you know, more inclusive recruitment and talent acquisition and, you know, things like retention and sort of progression of, you know, either underrepresented or marginalized groups or communities. So I think that leadership skin in the game is critical, like that sort of genuine skin in the game. And then, yeah, it's obviously, you know, looking at your recruitment and sort of talent acquisition programs is key, but I think more importantly, looking at progression and retention. And, you know, once you bring people in from diverse, you know, sort of backgrounds, experiences, you know, whatever, what's the, you know, what are exactly leadership doing to sort of create an environment where those people feel like they can, you know, I don't want to say be authentically your true selves because it feels quite hackneyed, but actually they feel like there isn't a part of them which is detrimental to their success or their performance or their progression, however they choose to express it.
Yeah.
You know, and making sure that people feel that they've got the route to sort of progress their careers. But that leadership piece is so key, because
you have to have
without it, it's lip service. I'm sure you see in the talent bit as well, you know, it's sort of,
we always get the same brief. Like it's almost and you kind of you might be like feeling a bit of tiredness, like about the situation. I'm not that's not me sitting on a thing, oh, none of you are doing it right, because you know, Jesus, we're not there either as a 12 person business. But the thing I think that's kind of tiring is someone wise, I won't name him because he'll be, his head will explode, JT, once said to me, follow the money.
Yeah.
Right. And do you know what happened when RFP, you know, the George Floyd situation happened and the money went to, holy shit.
Yeah.
Clients are asking for D&I. You know, that is now front and center.
Yeah.
Then the recession hit.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but it went away.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And then suddenly, I felt like that wasn't an important thing anymore.
Yeah.
And because that drumbeat wasn't happening anymore, maybe from the clients, definitely wasn't from the agencies, the level of importance, prioritized, it felt like it fell to the bottom of the list. And I'm set, it's coming back again.
Yeah.
Almost as the, you know, inflation's decreasing and recession's going away. Suddenly we're hearing, oh, what's your diversity and inclusion policy? Where have you been for the last 2 years, completely. Right? Do you sense that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. There was, it was quite interesting, because I just before obviously the, you know, the sort of murder of George Floyd, you got the feeling there was like a bit of a sense of, particularly when it came to sort of race and ethnicity, there was like diversity fatigue setting in within the agencies. That was obviously a sort of such a visceral global moment where no one could hide from what was going on. It was impossible to deny the reality of people's experiences, you know, and brands in particular stepping forward because there was that consumer pressure to do so. Yeah. And so then there was real investment and focus, commitments all over the place. And it kind of goes back to everything that we're saying, is that like those commitments have to be long-term and kind of sustainable. And I think at the time, a lot of people were making short-term commitments because they were feeling the pressure of the moment. And then as that sort of wave of pressure, you know, sort of dials down because, you know, news cycle gets occupied by other things and, you know, the recession bites in, the rest of it. What enough people hadn't done was sort of put sustainable programs, sustainable investment, and have things baked into their strategy that it sort of just carried on.
Yeah.
So it kind of became this sort of conscious trade-off choice between, oh yeah, but we need to, do we spend in RD&I or do we do this? And the truth is, you know, to the point, you have to look at both of those things as kind of connected, because there is so much evidence out there that like, if you have a diverse workforce that is inclusive, particularly when it comes to creativity, you get to new places, literally through the difference of thought.
Yeah.
And if that isn't central to a creative business, then I don't know how you're going to be competitive. And I think people are starting to realize that now. I think what's really interesting as well is the generational change. So, you know, obviously when George, that sort of George Floyd era, and actually the period sort of leading up to many of the sort of RD&I conversations, you still had like boomers and Gen X, and they were like the target market that a lot of brands were focusing on, and still, and also the population in agency world was.
Yeah.
Now it's like Gen Z's, right? And you know, we've got like, is it like Alpha knocking on the door, and millennials, and they are already very diverse in mindset and majority, and you know, obviously it's a generalization, but very, very different in terms of their perspective on the world.
Yeah.
Much more connected with everything that's going kind of out there, and much more aware of things. So there is now that internal pressure is coming back from employees.
Yes.
But they're also the clients. Like, I mean, you go into client meeting rooms now, and you know, people talk about Gen Z's, like they're literally our clients across, the, across the field. They're the people running the businesses that pay our checks. Yeah. So I think it's starting to come back now, because it feels like there's that sort of generational shift that's kind of happened, and you know, people are paying attention to it. And you see it not just inclusivity, but particularly around sustainability. I mean, any agency now that is not credible on that is just getting pushed to the side, you know?
Yeah, I could have sat here for an hour and a half longer. Yeah. That was fucking amazing. We've got literally 30 seconds.
Yep.
Before I let you go, you've got 21-year-old Ete.
Yeah.
He's entering the industry right now.
Yeah.
What one piece of advice did you give 21-year-old Ete?
It's a good question. I mean, I would say yes more to opportunity, because every time I said yes, whether it was a Shanghai thing or the AF thing, no, so they were like leapfrog moments in my career. And I wouldn't say I'm particularly play it safe all the time, but I definitely could have said yes to more more opportunities and just see where it took me.
Say yes more, young Ete.
Yeah.
Mate, thank you so much.
No worries,
that was amazing.
Thanks.